Good morning and happy Valentine's Day. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Joan Houston Hall, chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, received a letter from a doctor in Maine who recounted a story from his first practice in Allenton, Pennsylvania. One of his patients came in and said, "Doc, I've been riffing and I've got jags in my leaders." The doctor looked up the words in the Dictionary of American Regional English, and we'll let you know later what those words meant, proving that the Dictionary of American Regional English has many, many uses. And the fifth final volume of the 60,000 entry dictionary is about to be published. The people involved in this project have been collecting regional English from across the United States for the past 50 years. Joan Houston Hall is chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English. She is an expert on the American English language and its regional and social dialects. She is distinguished scientist of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, former president of the American Dialect Society, and the Dictionary Society of North America. She's an expert in American English from the colonial period to the present, regional variation in American English, social variation in American English, and lexicography. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Joan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. 55 is the number. And I would imagine that you'll have some regional English that you would like to bring to the airwaves, which we would love to hear this hour. Did I give you the email? talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Joan, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Congratulations. What a project, wasn't it?
Indeed it was, and we are absolutely delighted to see it in print.
I would imagine you are.
But reaching the end of the alphabet doesn't mean that the job is done.
You will be doing updates to this?
Yes, we are anticipating an electronic edition in 2013, and the hope is that we will keep a small staff going here so that we can update the language as we see it changing.
And language always changes.
Yes.
Let's talk about the history of this, how it got started, and the enormous efforts that were taken to gather all of these words.
Yes. Well, 50 years ago this year, Frederick Cassidy, who was a professor of English here at the UW-Madison, was appointed by the American Dialect Society as the chief editor of this project. It didn't have a name then. It was an idea. It was intended that a big survey of American English would be comparable to a survey of English dialects that had been done at the early part of the 20th century. So it was obviously a huge project because America is very much larger than Great Britain, and so it took a long time in preparation. But Fred Cassidy had been doing some work here in Wisconsin. He had done a dialect survey of Wisconsin communities that allowed him to test out a huge questionnaire. This had questions about everything that has to do with our daily lives, from time and weather and food and clothing and farming to religion and health and disease and marriage and courtship and anything that had to do with our daily lives. So he perfected that questionnaire, and by 1965 he was ready to send field workers out to 1,002 communities.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. These communities were carefully selected so that they reflected the population as of the 1960 census. So there were as many urban communities as reflected that proportion of the country, and then through small cities, villages, towns, and rural areas. So it was a very carefully constructed survey to reflect the kind of people we were at that particular time.
And there has been an idea that's been fairly prevalent for some years now that because of advertising, because of strip malls, et cetera, that the English language has been pretty much homogenized. You, the dictionary, would prove that that's not entirely the case, is it?
I really dislike the term homogenized when it comes to American English, because yes, it's true that language changes, but it doesn't change at the same pace everywhere, and it doesn't change in the same ways everywhere. So even if there are some terms, some nationwide commercial terms that tend to push out some of the local terms, there are still thousands of local and regional terms that persist. We don't have reasons to change the way we speak unless the people we're speaking to don't understand us. So here in Wisconsin, for instance, there's no reason not to say, where's the nearest bubbler?
Right.
Unless we're perhaps up in the Northwest, and maybe they don't understand it there. But there are still plenty of ways that our language varies from one place to another. And those are the kinds of things we're collecting, and we are absolutely delighted when we recognize that there still is tremendous variety.
And how did you get to those words? Was it what kinds of questions did you ask that allowed you to discover the words, the language that's in a dictionary?
It started with a huge questionnaire with all these questions about our daily lives. And the field workers who went to these 1,002 communities were asked to find people who had lived in those communities all their lives. So they were really good representatives of local speech. Now, sometimes, because this questionnaire could take up to a week to complete, it took several people in the same community to do a full questionnaire. But in each case, we had details of age, sex, race, amount of education, and the community type. So we knew what speakers were providing which responses. And not only could we map where they occurred, we could look at the social statistics and see whether words seemed to be more prevalent among women than men, or older rather than younger people, well-educated or poorly educated, and that kind of thing. So anyway, when these field workers went to the communities and found people who had lived there all their lives, they asked them these very, very detailed questions. And those responses then were later computerized, and we created a map to reflect the population as of the 1960s. And the result is that in the dictionary, we can include maps showing where particular words were used. Now, the maps are a little funny looking because they were population adjusted. So, for instance, Connecticut's a pretty small state, but we know that it has lots of people. So in the DARE map, Connecticut had to be enlarged. But New Mexico, on the other hand, which is a huge state, doesn't have very many people. And so it was shrunk down to just a little sliver. And in that way, we have a good representation of population density. And every dot means one community. And just by looking where the dots are on the map, we can see whether something is indeed regional.
And what did you determine when you looked at who was using the words women, men, older, younger?
Well, a number of things. In terms of the regionality, what we discovered is that there are many, many different regions, from very small ones, such as a city or part of a city, to most of a state, to most of a region, to most of the country, but not all of the country. And in terms of social distributions, lots of the terms we found were probably going out of use because most of the people who gave them in 1965 to 70 were over 60 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't really very many gender differences. There were a few cases where some words that would have been considered rather uncouth in the 60s were used primarily by men, and that was probably a reflection of social mores at the time, because women were much less free in their speech than they are now. But we didn't find a lot of gender differences. In terms of black and white differences, there were quite a few. Education differences, yes, some, but often they were in things like past tenses of verbs and things like that. So kind of what you would expect in terms of social distributions.
Did you find yourself, Joan, as I did when I was looking at some of these words, saying, I love that word. I have to figure out some way to use that. And, oh, I love that word. Next week, I'll have to figure out how to use that word. And did you indeed use those words you learned?
As you work with them, you think, oh, wow, this is great. And you read the quotations and you realize that there's a lot of humor in the way people use words. Or even if there's not humor, it's still fascinating to see the differences. But this is a scholarly work, and we take it seriously, and we get involved in it. But we go home at night, and if somebody asks, well, what great words did you see today? All of a sudden, the mind goes blank, because they're not really a part of our experience.
I love this word, and I was trying to figure out the correct way to use it, but it's got a great sound, whoopin' soccer.
Oh, yes.
That's a good word.
Yeah, and that's a very Wisconsin word.
I don't know it. I didn't know it until yesterday.
Yeah, well, originally it meant something that was really good of its kind. So, man, that concert was a whoopin' soccer. Or anything that was really good. But then it became associated in particular with a really strong or a really fantastic drink. So a whoopin' soccer is also a very strong drink.
Ah. And the sentence that I used to start this show, nobody would know, unless you were perhaps in Allentown, Pennsylvania, what in the world this patient was saying. Dr. Ivan Rifton and I got jags in my leaders. Can you imagine as a doctor somebody saying that to you? You'd just scratch your head, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes. And that's why DARE is so wonderfully valuable, because many times physicians grow up in one area and then find themselves posted to another. And there are hundreds of folk and regional names for ailments and diseases. So in Western Pennsylvania, to rift means to belch or to burp. And it's a fairly restricted part of the country where it has that meaning. So, yes, the poor doctor really was up a creek.
So he found the dictionary and got the answer.
Or he certainly would have found it there had that
right.
volume been published at
exactly.
that point.
Now, yeah. Is it difficult to pinpoint the years and the origins of these words?
We try very hard to find the earliest written quote for every word, because DARE is a historical dictionary, just as the Oxford English Dictionary is. And so we try to get the whole history of every word, including a very recent example. So in Volume 5, which will officially be published next month, we will actually have quotations from 2011. And the field work that was done for DARE in the mid-60s is essentially a snapshot of American English as of that period. But the full entry in DARE gives a whole history from the very earliest that we know about up through its use throughout the centuries or the decades, whatever the case may be, up to the present. So we hope that we give a very full explanation of every word that we include.
Yeah, you do indeed. And how much work must have been involved in putting all of this together, I can't imagine.
Yes, it's been a long haul.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls for our guest, and here's how you can reach us. Our guest is Joan Houston Hall, chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, and the fifth volume. This has been a work in progress for 50 years now. The last volume will be published in March. We're talking about how the words were gathered and differences in the use of words in various parts of the country. And we have yet to discuss how this dictionary is used. It's used for a number of purposes that you wouldn't normally think of. Solving crime, of course, actors use this to prepare for roles, to find out what regional differences are, regional dialects are, and many other professions. Doctors have used this as well. So here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Joan is is an expert on the American English language and its regional and social dialects, distinguished scientist, English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, chief editor, as I said, of the Dictionary of American Regional English. 800-486-8655 is our number, and you're invited to join us for this Valentine's Day conversation on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, one of the authors of News for All People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. This hour, the almost complete Dictionary of American Regional English. The chief editor is our guest this hour of the program, Joan Houston Hall. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For you to join our conversation. We mentioned, as the phone calls are coming in, Joan, the uses of this dictionary. It's been used for people to help solve crimes, which is not what you would think of automatically when you would think of a dictionary like this.
Well, that's true. One of the people who has told us about his use of it in that way is a former professor at Georgetown named Roger Shai, who was able to take the manifesto of the Unabomber before it had been published and look at it very, very carefully. And in terms of the use of language, he was able to identify the writer as someone who was middle-aged, probably from the Middle West, but who had lived in Northern California, who probably had a PhD, but not in the humanities, who was who had had some religious background that was no longer practiced. And he identified this man in terms of a profile, just to a T. The profilers on the FBI's side of the equation had him as a young tradesman from the West Coast, totally wrong based on the language. So Roger was able to use not just DARE, but a lot of other linguistic materials to get this very carefully maintained profile. But the example that most people resonate with and that we find to be the most exciting was Roger's telling us about a case where there was a child abduction, and the ransom note that was left for the parents said, in part, leave $10,000 in a diaper bag on the Devil Strip at the corner of 18th and Carlson. The Devil Strip?
Right.
How could he find out about that? It wasn't in any standard dictionaries of English or American English, but it was in DARE. And in DARE, you discover that the Devil Strip is that strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street. In Madison, it's called the Terrace, but it goes by dozens of names, from parking to parking strip to parkway to terrace to tree lawn to berm to boulevard to swale to verge, tree belt, tree box.
Oh, my goodness. Listen to all those.
But in a very circumscribed part of Ohio, in the triangle outlined by Akron, Cleveland, and Youngstown, it's called the Devil Strip. And it turned out that one of the people on the suspect list had grown up in Akron.
Oh.
And when he was confronted with the linguistic as well as the other evidence, he confessed.
Isn't that fascinating?
We were really thrilled to see that our work could be so tangibly useful.
Yes. Oh, my. Let's go to phone calls. Daniel, our first caller in Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. It's not only what we say, but how we say it. As a northern Wisconsinite, I pronounce long vowels. Do you know where that characteristic comes from? And since you're at the end of the dictionary, did you include the definition of our Norwegian-derived phrase, ufta?
Yes, we certainly did include ufta. It's a great entry. The pronunciation, as you rightly point out, is also a crucial part of our linguistic identity. And our pronunciations are formed by a number of features, including where our parents came from, what ethnic groups populated our communities, and influences of other nearby regions. So in parts of Minnesota and parts of northern North Dakota and even parts of Wisconsin were sometimes influenced by Canadian pronunciations. But in particular, our pronunciations reflect our inheritance from Norwegian, German, Finnish, whatever ethnic groups have been prevalent in our communities.
There is, I don't know if this was done when all of the workers went to these various areas to interview people, but there was an English recording of Arthur the Rat that was used in this research somehow. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes. In addition to asking people the questions in this huge questionnaire, the field workers were asked to have each informant, and informant just means somebody who gives information, it's not a political term. Each informant was asked to make a tape recording, and the tape recording consisted of two parts. One was the reading of this silly little story named Arthur the Rat that was created in order to include all of the contrastive sounds in American English. So by having people all across the country read the same passage, we could get really good comparative information about pronunciation patterns. But we also asked people to simply talk to the field worker about whatever it was that interested them. And in this way, we gathered a magnificent collection of regional oral histories. And these segments of relaxed conversation are what have been particularly useful to dialect coaches and to actors who are trying to pick up the dialect of a particular place. So, for instance, a woman who is a dialect coach at the Juilliard School in New York asked to hear, probably 20 or so different interviews from various parts of Oklahoma when she was doing the revised edition or the revised broadcast on Broadway of Oklahoma. So just by listening to relaxed conversational speech, a really good actor who has a good ear can just fall into that local pattern and reproduce it in his role.
Oh, and the really good actors have to have that error. You notice it right off the bat, don't you?
Yes, indeed. Hmm.
Thank you, Daniel, so much for the call. Jim in Janesville is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Fascinating subject. I think it's really neat that such a scholarly approach is taken on this. But one of the things I'm wondering is, in the course of research, how do you differentiate the line of really what is, was it the regional word versus a slang or an idiom, and even moving into where is the line of profanity?
We tried hard to concentrate on regionalisms, which to us means both something that can be shown to be limited in terms of geography, but we also included what we called folk language. And these are the kinds of words that we learn from our family and friends rather than our teachers and books and newspapers. But sometimes determining what's folk language as opposed to what's slang is a little bit difficult. In general, slang tends to be very ephemeral, because slang is what identifies us as belonging to a particular group. So imagine if you have a teenaged son or daughter, and that child is engrossed in whatever local slang is going around in his high school. It's great, and it shows that he's part of the group, but as soon as the 12-year-old brother starts using it, forget it. Because slang is a very in-group kind of thing. And because it's so ephemeral, we tried not to include it. But sometimes one person's folk term is another person's slang. And I'm sure that some of the entries in the dictionary, people might say, well, that sounds like slang to me. But others would say, well, I don't think so. I think it's just idiomatic or folk. So the lines are fuzzy.
Okay. Well, great. I think it's great work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, so much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Dick in Waukesha. Hi, Dick.
Hi.
Hi.
I work for the Forest Service, and I started my career in Ely, Minnesota.
Oh.
And There I met a woman who later became my wife, who had taught over in Kingsford, taught English. Anyway, there were some phrases that we heard. People would say, let's go show, which meant let's go to the movies.
Uh-huh.
And wow for pretty, and oh for fast.
Yeah, very interesting. But, well, the go show is a very common expression in the UP, and I expect that this is reflective of the foreign language backgrounds there, which are often Finnish and Scandinavian.
You might have heard it there, too, because we lived in a couple of places in the UP. But I have a little, the pronunciation of the words, Finlanders, was the men, I met them in the woods, you know, they were woodcutters, and they came over here in their teens and early 20s and learned their English. And there's a story of the Bud Oxley, one of the grocery stores in Waters Meat, told this about a fellow who was working as a woodcutter for a guy named Smith Cedar. They were cutting cedar poles for small telephone poles,
uh-huh.
And they called him Cedar Pole Smith. Well, Eno was the cutter, and he arrived in Waters Meat and went to Bud Oxley's store. And, hey, Eno, good to see you. And he said, how did you get here? He says, I got ride in that with that cedar pole Smith in his brand-new Riesel car. He said that we were at that speed gale was reading 85 miles in 1 hour. The road looked like shoelace, he said.
The road looked like what?
Shoelace.
Oh.
And so then he said, well, what can I do for you? He said, I want some reen. And Bud told me this story. Anyway, he looked off at Bud. Reen. What the heck is reen? You know, that keep the lies out. Screen that keeps the flies out.
Had to work at that one, huh, Dick? Thank you very much. Thanks for your call. He was paying close attention to what people were saying. Paula in La Crosse. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
Hi.
You talked about have women's language or sayings. My mother had four sisters, and they grew up in southern Indiana. And my mother would be 94 now, but once a month, the girls were on the rag.
Uh-huh. Sure, I've heard that.
Yeah, I wondered if it was just real regional in that part of the country, although it would make sense that since we didn't have Kotex or whatever, sanitary napkins, I guess, that maybe that had a wider range of use.
I think it was much wider than just Indiana, but if you will give me half a minute, excuse me.
It's okay.
Yes, it's used in various phrases referring to menstruation, including things like she's got the rag on, or she's on the rag, she's wearing the rag, she's putting the rag on, it's ragging time. And these do seem to be quite scattered. I don't see a comment here in the quotation that suggests that it's mostly used by women, but it wouldn't be surprising if that were true.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. Well, that was my comment.
Thank you, Paula.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. Bill in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I have two questions. One, there's been a gradual devolution in English grammar. In two examples I'll give you. You see it on the news, people who are supposedly, you know, edit their copy and are supposedly careful about what they say and how they say it. But people no longer ask by whom something was done. They ask by who something is done. They'll refer to less people being in a room rather than fewer people being in a room. And I guess my second question is, I mean, is this something that's recent, pan language? Is this throughout the Americas or just across the English-speaking world or whatever. But I guess my second question is, I met a very interesting professor as an undergrad. This was many years ago. You know, the man that's recently passed away. He was a professor, Hak-Chin Kim.
Hmm.
He was a professor of linguistics and classical literature at the University of Oregon.
Uh-huh.
And he was doing research on, this was back in the 70s, he was doing research on American regional English. And he had I remember him showing me he says it was preliminary, his English language, his regional English language map of the United States. And he had particular interest in the Pacific Northwest because Pacific Northwest is quite a motley mess of linguistically, and anyway, I just wondered, he was a very he was Korean by birth, educated at Cambridge University in England. He dressed and sounded very British, but though he was fluent in at least 10 languages. And I just wondered if the guests had ever heard of him or heard of his work.
Well, I don't know of his work. I do know of work in the Pacific Northwest by Carol Reed and Henry Person. So perhaps they were familiar with one another. I would guess so. But I don't happen to know about your friend.
And would you like to make, it's not really the subject of the dictionary, but you speak so beautifully and you're an expert in use of the words in English. Have you noticed a decline at all, or is this just something that we like to harp on, in the way that we use the English language?
There certainly is change all the time. And for those of us who worked very carefully to know about cases of pronouns, it's distressing to realize that many speakers today, particularly younger people, don't distinguish between objective and nominative case and don't make a distinction between less and few. If we care about these things, we think of the lack of distinction as the caller said, devolution rather than evolution, or we think the language is going to hell in a handbasket. But people have thought that for centuries. Whenever anything that we care about changes, it feels to us like a decline or a change in the wrong direction. And I confess that I share those distressing moments when I realize, for instance, that the verb to go seems to be losing its status as a strong verb. You hear all the time, if I could have went, rather
yes.
than if I could have gone. And I suspect that within a few generations, we may not have the go, went, gone distinction that we have now. I don't think there's anything that we can do to stop it, and hand-wringing won't help, as I've discovered. But I just have to tell myself I'm going to stand back and watch and just be a historian and say, oh, this is changing.
So you don't interrupt and say, excuse me, that's incorrect.
No, indeed.
You don't.
I like to think of myself as a descriptive linguist rather than a prescriptive linguist. I can be prescriptive for my own use and try very hard to adhere to the details that I was taught. But in terms of other people's speech, I'm certainly not going to correct it.
One of the other wonderful things about this dictionary, and I have a copy of the... Whoa, I turned my mic off. It's a big dictionary, is in front of me, is you can look at these words and you get lost in almost this short story of what's happening. I just randomly turned the page to stew the dish rag. Well, I never heard that expression, and it's a whole interesting description. You get taken back to a different place in the country and a very vivid description of what this is.
Yes, well, you are at that page, and I am not at the moment, so why don't you tell us what it
is? It's page 274.
Okay.
And it's on the right-hand side. It's the first entry, stew the dish rag. Go to great lengths to prepare a meal, especially for unexpected guests. It's a great expression. She announced her intention of putting to big pot into little one, dish rag and all, which means great things. 1893. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, and that one you get a twofer because you not only have the stew the dish rag business, but to put the big pot in the little one is also a nice regional expression and means to go to great lengths to make something very special.
Yes, I like that one. And you must get lost in these because you can find something like that on every page.
Yes, it's very fun. It's a wonderful browsing tool as well as a very scholarly resource.
Yes. Nicely put. Thank you, Bill, for your call. Barbara in Spring Green. Hi.
Hi. The word dibs is in the dictionary, but I grew up in Chicago, and we were fond of saying van dibs, like that's really mine.
Uh-huh.
And then it went to van dibs, and I just wondered if that word is in use now. I mean, the word dibs is. I have dibs on something.
Yeah, there are lots of children's calls with van, vent, vince, venture, and probably they all go back originally to venture, and then venture got shortened to vent and vents, and van was an alteration of that. And it's used in all sorts of game calls or exclamations to make it a little more emphatic.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Arnie in Madison. Hi, Arnie.
Yes, I thought I'd just comment on the fellow up front who had interacted with Finns in the northern part of the state and in Minnesota as well. Those people were speaking Finglish, which is a phenomenon that Finnish linguists have had a great interest in ever since immigration started in the late 19th century. And Finglish really resulted because Finns don't speak an Indo-European language. They speak Finno-Ugric. There were many sounds that were foreign to them, and the grammatical structure was different. So what they would do is take English language words and put them into a Finnish grammatical structure and create this unique language, which only they could understand. People in Finland couldn't, called Finglish. And I'll just give you a couple examples. For instance, a car became a kaara, K-A-A-R-A, and a bedroom became a petiruma, which is P-E-T-I-R-U-U-M-A. And these sounds result because Finnish doesn't have a sound such as G as in goat or D as in door or B as in baker. So they had to change those sounds to something else that came like a P or a K or whatever. So it made for a rather interesting language, but totally unintelligible to other people, to outsiders, that is.
Yes, thank you. That phenomenon of language contact is something that happens wherever two different languages come together. So you have things like Spanglish, for instance, and I don't know if it's Korean-glish or what, but putting two different languages together with the phonological system of one, a grammatical system probably of the same one, with the words of another, is a very interesting phenomenon.
Yes,
and
it is.
It lasts for a generation or two, but by the time the children of those speakers have been acculturated, it becomes very much less obvious.
Yes, it certainly does. And it's interesting that there's quite a large dictionary that was produced in Finland about 20 years ago that got the last made recordings of the last speakers of Finglish so that at least they'd be preserved.
Oh,
that's wonderful.
I'm glad that was done. Thank you, Arnie.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. We go to Bob next in Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Kathleen. I have a question for your guest. It is simply, where did we get kitty corner? Now, I've always lived in Wisconsin. I don't know if kitty corner is regionalism or if it's universal, but I can't imagine where we get kitty corner from.
Well, it's a variation of catty corner, which comes from Catter corner, C-A-T-E-R, meaning, I believe it was diagonal. And indeed, kitty corner and catty corner are differently regional. Kitty corner is very northern, and catty corner tends to be very much more southern.
Oh, you have such a complete answer. That was wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, there you go, Bob. Can't get more than that. Thank you. Thank you very much for your call. Jane in Middleton. Hi, Jane.
Good morning. Happy Valentine's
Thank
Day.
Thank you. To you, too.
I have two colloquialisms to share with you, and then I have a question about pronunciation changes.
Okay.
The first colloquialism is in the eastern part of Wisconsin on Lake Michigan area, and it's inso.
Yes.
I take it that means that, don't you agree with me?
Yes, it's from essentially, isn't it so?
Yes.
But it's part of a very interesting set of what are called tag questions. So in German, you'll make a statement and then end it by saying, nicht wahr? Isn't it true?
Ah.
And that's been translated into English in German communities, particularly Milwaukee, into Anna,
yeah,
as in, ain't it true? And Anna is also ainso. And ainso easily becomes inso, or even enso in the Fox River Valley. So children will say, Johnny hit me, inso, inso.
Well, the other one is I married a gentleman from southwest Louisiana, and he would always have the rather funny phrase to say, you want to get down? And being from the north, it was like, get down, get down, get down. But what he meant is get out of the car.
Oh my goodness, I never would have thought of that.
Yeah, it, you know, I guess it was a carriage thing. You know, you get down from the carriage.
Oh.
That's the only thing I'm thinking that it could be.
Yes, uh-huh. I think you're right.
Yes, and then the other question I had was, when I was young, I grew up, if you want to get to Carnegie Hall, you practice, practice, practice. Now it's pronounced Carnegie. Why the difference in pronunciation?
Well, I really don't know what the family preferred. I've heard both Carnegie and Carnegie. I think for most English speakers who have not ever heard it, the instinct would be to put the stress on the first syllable. But proper names are just an entirely different ballgame. And I should say, not as a correction, but just as a matter of information to Kathleen, that my name is Joan Houston Hall, and I pronounce the Houston not like the city in Texas, but like the street in New York.
Oh.
And there's certainly no way for anybody to know that.
Oh, forgive me, please. You have to have your name pronounced correctly. Okay.
So I still say Carnegie, and I think that the Carnegie Foundation in New York says it that way as well, but I'm not 100% sure.
Thank you so much, Jane, for your call. In addition to the interviews, and I'm wondering how extensive the research was in looking through newspapers, histories, novels, diaries, letters, government documents, and all of the other written sources that you used for doing research and compiling these dictionaries.
Yes, that's a huge component of the dictionary. And in recent years, the last decade or 15 years, that part of the dictionary research has become incredibly more complex by virtue of all the wonderful digital libraries that are available now. So when we first started this in the 60s, we had huge collections of print materials, and we had lots of people who took quotations from them. But it's a very small amount compared to the vast array of material that's available just the click of a mouse today. So the reason that it took longer to do our fifth volume than any other volume was that we had this huge embarrassment of riches to look through.
That's a nice phrase, embarrassment of riches. Joan Houston Hall, chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, is our guest this hour, and we're talking to her because this project, well, it won't ever be completed because there will always be new words and they'll be doing updates, but this massive research work that has been published in four volumes and now the fifth and final volume, Dictionary of American Regional English, will be published in just a couple weeks, and she's here to talk about it. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go next to Casey in Pewaukee. Hi. Hello?
I didn't, there was a noise on the line. I'm hoping you said Kathy in Pewaukee.
Cassie, it's Cassie. Hi, Cassie. Yes, I did.
Okay. I'm assuming, of course, that Bubbler made it into one of the editions. since that's a Wisconsin term and also used in some places out east.
Yes.
Okay. And then we lived in Indiana and heard different versions of piano.
Uh-huh.
We heard piana and piana.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then I wanted to comment along with the fewer and less. Something that seems to have changed is lay and lie.
Yes.
Because my mom always said, you know, hens lay, people lie. And and I think that when I hear newscasters and everybody using what just grates. So.
Yes, I share your distress over that, but I have finally decided that there's not a thing I can do about it, and that distinction will not be long for this world.
I bet there is something you could do about it, of all people, but I understand you're not doing it. Here's an email from Chris. My family played a lot of cards. There were always so many specific words or phrases, such as, I have a dog from every town. That meant you had a variety of cards, and nothing went together for rummy, canasta, poker, etc. Is this common with cards or other things like sports?
Yes. Card or dice game that I think of immediately is to have a horse apiece, which has become part of the general lexicon, at least in Wisconsin. If you don't care what happens and you are not going to make a choice, you might say, oh, it's a horse apiece. And that comes from a dice game called horse. But other card game terms, I know less about the terms in the games themselves than about regional terms for the games. Of course, here in Wisconsin, both Schafskopf and Sheepshead, the translation, are very popular and well known. But if you look at the DARE maps for those terms, you'll see that nobody else knows those.
Right,
almost totally Wisconsin.
Yeah, how true. And another email, how about the history of buy now? Is it a Wisconsin phrase? Buy now.
Oh, I don't think so.
It's just something used commonly. Buy now.
Yeah, there are Wisconsin uses of buy. For instance, if you say, oh, I'm going by John's for dinner.
Yes.
You don't mean you're going to drive past John's house. You mean you're going to stop and go in and have dinner.
Right.
And that's just a reflection of the German heritage in this part of the country, where we're using by as the Germans would, the German B-E-I, rather than our B-Y. But it has just been adopted into English.
Sue in Eau Claire. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Yeah, an interesting phrase that I've heard from a community that is a Polish community near where I live is if someone is asking what a lady's maiden name is, they would say, who is she from by her mother, or who is she from home?
Yes.
Oh.
I've heard that, who is she from home. I haven't heard the from by her mother.
Yeah. And then I was wondering, and that's kind of an example of it, but the order of words and how people who know a foreign language and then they translate things to another language and they leave the order the same because maybe their vowels come before their subject or whatever, is that an influence on some of the colloquialisms that you've worked with?
Oh, yes, certainly. And there are classic examples like throw mama from the train a kiss.
Yes.
those kinds of things usually last for a generation or two but don't persist. But sometimes they do stay. And one of the things that is common in Wisconsin and upper Midwest English that is a remnant of many different foreign languages is the phrase, I'm going to the store. Want to come with? Which is a reflection of quite a few different Germanic languages. It's not just German, but people in other parts of the country are left feeling as though something must be coming. Want to go with me?
Oh, that's funny. Now, how do you get the dictionary? It will be published in March?
Yes,
okay.
That's the official publication date, but it is available now. You can get it from Harvard University Press, or you can get it from a local bookstore, or you can get it online.
All right. And tell me how it will be updated. It's not really finished. You don't want to think of a work like this as finished ever.
That's true. Right now, we're working on a volume of supplementary data, which will be published early next year. It will have wonderful contrast maps. So now, if you want to see all the maps for Hero, Hoagie, Sub, Grinder, Cuban, Torpedo, all these sandwiches, you have to flip through 5 volumes of text. But in this next volume, you'll be able to just open up 2 pages and see them displayed all in one place.
Mm.
So it's going to be a great browsing book, and it'll be a great teaching tool.
Mm-hmm.
But the following year, we will start the electronic edition, and then we will be regularly updating and trying to keep as current as possible.
Thank you, Joan. Thanks. It was a great hour.
Well, thank you.
Joan Houston Hall, chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, started at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and finished there just recently. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. All I got to say is whoopin' soccer. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations yet to come. Be with you tomorrow.